program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and this series is called Favorite Poets. And so, as we have mentioned, Opening the Hand is another book by W.S. Merwin. And now let me see, I used to know what year this was. I think this was 83. And I've chosen two, and then one by about Berryman, because that is a gem.
Okay.
I would love that if you would.
The first one is
The Waters.
The Waters,
yes.
Which is a poem about writing about one's past. I think one always writes about the past, you know, because language is made of the past. But The Waters. I was the whole summer remembering more than I knew, as though anything could stand still in the waters. There were lives that turned and appeared to wait, and I went toward them looking. Sounds carry in water, but not what I called so far. Sun and moon shone into the moving water, and after many days, joys and griefs I had not thought were mine, woke in this body's altering dream, knowing where they were. Faces that would never die returned toward our light through mortal waters.
Memory in sight. And the other was, I think, The Line of Trees. Is that the one I chose?
Mm-hmm. This is about a place in well, you don't need to know. It's called The Line of Trees. Along the west of the woods is a row of tall pines. The man who planted them came from an island thousands of miles to the south, and now with his wife, for a long time a nurse, but lately not right in the head, who came from an island thousands of miles from his. He lives down the road since their small house in the woods burned beyond repair, but he still comes by every so often to ignore the mailbox, rusted sedan full of vines, brown fruit in the grassy ruts. And when he has gone, a pheasant barks from hiding, bird of a far continent. And whenever the boughs part suddenly to reveal the yellow house wall with its window, what they show is a mirror full of western light.
I don't think there is a poet with as many diverse voices as you have had over the years. You can speak of the daily act, the ordinary. You can speak of memory. You can speak of a life beyond our knowing. You can speak of the natural world, and you honor that and are very well known as a champion of the natural world in your work. You have done so many different things. I don't think you dare to stop and think about it. It would be, you'd trip over your shoes if you stopped to think of all you've accomplished.
It would be terrible to start going back and thinking about what you've done.
It's more important
to think of what you haven't done.
For the sake of the audience, who actually, some of them may never have met you before, it's kind of nice to give a retrospective, and that's what we're doing here. Are we on Berryman?
We are.
Well, would you set that up and tell our audience who he was?
Well, John Berryman was one of the great poets of the generation before mine, and I think of Berryman, Lowell, Rethke, Elizabeth Bishop, Randall Jarrell as the great figures of that generation. They all died relatively young. I mean, none of them got past their 60s. And Berryman, of course, took his own life before he was 60 in Minnesota. His father had committed suicide before him when he was a child, and it had haunted him all his life. Alcohol had become a problem, and John was a tormented and incredibly brilliant man. His writings about Shakespeare had just been published, and he used to talk about Shakespeare brilliantly. John was a very difficult man, talked incredibly about poetry, and he was passionate about it. He was absolutely, ruthlessly passionate. And I would go when I was 19 every week and take him some poems, and he would tell me how terrible they were and destroy them one after the other. He cared about nobody's feelings. He felt that if your feelings were involved, the poetry was far more important than that. And he was ruthless to himself in the same way. I mean, a very, very beautiful essay about him by Phil Levine in a book called The Bread of Time about John as a teacher. Simply wonderful. And about John talking about that great poem, that sonnet of Edwin Arlington Robinson's about the god Apollo, which is about poetry and how nobody ever really measures up in the long run.
Hmm.
This poem is called Berryman, and of course, he became very well known as a poet. I knew him when I was very young as a teacher.
Was he at Princeton?
He was at Princeton, yeah. In a building which has since been torn down. And I should say that I also met Jimmy Merrill in Berryman's office when he came by Princeton. Jimmy was a year older than I. He was 20 and I was 19, so this was interesting. We were all there together. Berryman. I will tell you what he told me in the years just after the war, as we then called the Second World War. Don't lose your arrogance yet, he said. You can do that when you're older. Lose it too soon and you may merely replace it with vanity. Just one time he suggested changing the usual order of the same words in a line of verse. Why point out a thing twice? He suggested I pray to the muse, get down on my knees and pray right there in the corner, and he said he meant it, literally. It was in the days before the beard and the drink, but he was deep in tides of his own through which he sailed, chin sideways and head tilted like a tacking sloop. He was far older than the dates allowed for, much older than I was. He was in his 30s. He snapped down his nose with an accent I think he had affected in England. As for publishing, he advised me to paper my wall with rejection slips. His lips and the bones of his long fingers trembled with the vehemence of his views about poetry. He said the great presence that permitted everything and transmitted it in poetry was passion. Passion was genius, and he praised movement and invention. I had hardly begun to read. I asked, how can you ever be sure that what you write is really any good at all? And he said, you can't. You can't. You can never be sure. You die without knowing whether anything you wrote was any good. If you have to be sure, don't write.
Am I watching you correcting the text in my books as you go along?
A couple of tiny typos.
Well, how will we ever know they're yours?
Well,
they could
you
be. I can't go to Sotheby's and they'll say, well, your husband did that. I'll say, no, W.S. Merwin did that. Well, you can always tell a good story, and that's one thing I'd say about your diverse voices. An anecdote can make a fabulous poem, and that is a good anecdote about Berryman. And I bet he did say that.
Which did he say?
If you have to worry about it, don't write.
It's all true. I didn't make anything up.
I believe that. This is a book that I bet you and I have, and I don't know how many other people. It's kind of old, and it is a very interesting book that you should have fastened to. And yet I'm not surprised. They're aphorisms, right?
They're aphorisms.
And by an Argentinian.
Well, actually, he was born in Italy, Antonio Porcia, and went there as a... he was born in 1886. And he went to... His family took him to Buenos Aires in 1911. And he became Spanish, and he was a painter. And we don't know what else he was. I mean, because it, not, I mean, Roberto Juarez, whom you mentioned earlier, was one of the people who knew him. He was a very, very retired man with no money ever. He held his clothes together with safety pins and things. And he did have some paintings that other painters had given him. But in the course of his life, he wrote 600 aphorisms. And I saw a few of them in a little tiny version in French years ago in the 60s, and was fascinated by them, and found out where they've been published in Buenos Aires. So I got the original in Spanish.
Oh, so you discovered him in
a way. I discovered him in French, and then I wanted to find the original, and I got the original, found that the French translation wasn't very accurate. So I took to carrying the Spanish around in my pocket, and I never thought of translating it, but I got curious. I mean, some of them got in my head, and I started translating them in the margin. Before long, I had quite a lot of them translated, but I didn't think of doing a book, and then I thought, well, I put them together and see what happened, and there have been a number of tiny editions of this. This is about a third. This book is called Voices.
Is that the Big Table series?
This is the Big Table.
Yeah, that was a... I don't think that exists anymore, that
no,
series.
No, it doesn't. Not, but, it's out of print now, but...
But even if you read one page, they are luminescent thoughts and remarkable that you have preserved them, and so I think it's a contribution to share them.
The title is a translation of his title, which is Voces, and it's Voices in English. And this is a page almost at random out of the book, and it's six little aphorisms, and they're almost all one sentence or two sentences, no more. Truth has very few friends, and those few are suicides. Treat me as you should treat me, not as I should be treated. Man goes nowhere. Everything comes to men like the morning. He who holds me by a thread is not strong. The thread is strong. A little candor never leaves me. It is what protects me. A door opens to me. I go in and am faced with 100 closed doors. He's all like that. Here are a few more. This is another teeny page, a page I like even better. Only a few arrive at nothing because the way is long. I am in myself so little that what they do with me scarcely interests me. Certainties are arrived at only on foot. Man, when he realizes that he is an object of comedy, does not laugh. In my silence, only my voice is lacking.
I wonder if he appreciated the fact that you made him known even a little bit more than he was.
Well, I don't know, because... Whether he actually knew about the book, I never got to meet him. I wanted to meet him, and I never did. He was 82 when he died, so...
I didn't know that.
No.
And to live a life probably with no material rewards.
None.
None at all. I have just chosen that book, this book you're holding in your hand, which is Selected Translations, and that was from 48 to what year? 1948 to...
68.
68. Okay. First of all, because it's... They just don't make paper like that anymore.
No, they don't.
That is a real heavy book.
Well, this was a book that was put together by Harry Ford, who died in March. He was a wonderful designer of books as well as an impassioned editor of poetry, who put together one of the most remarkable lists of mid-century, which was the list that began at Athenaeum and then he took to Scribner's and eventually. Some of it to Knopf.
How did Athenaeum turn over the work to Copper Canyon? Nicely?
Well, what happened was that Copper Canyon has been reprinting the books that Athenaeum did, which was before I went to Knopf, before Harry and I both
went
to Knopf.
It's all very friendly, this interchange, because...
Oh, yes, because those were books before Knopf began publishing me. But.
Right, okay. To go back to Selected Translations, I had two questions about this book. First, who chose the poets?
Oh, I did.
Well, I have never, some of these poets, of course, I've never heard of, and they're from antiquity. But the first woman was in the 1900s, right? I mean, I'm not scolding the book, but I thought it'd be nice if we read her, because I'd never heard of her before.
Oh, yes. Well, she's a French poet, Anne-Marie Kegels. She is actually, if she's still alive,
yeah.
I think she is actually Flemish, Belgian.
So, to honor her, we will read that, if
yes,
it's okay.
Yes, she's a poet who's not very well known, but I mean, these came out of reading from other languages, and just if I liked a poem that seemed as though it might go into English, I would see what I could do. This is just a poem I found and liked. It's called Nocturnal Heart by a Flemish-French woman named Anne-Marie Kegels, K-E-G-E-L-S. Nocturnal Heart. Master of blood, I am yours, O tireless captain, upright on the plains of sand at night. At night, I hear you march toward a doubtful sea with footsteps falsely restrained. At that time, I touch my breath. I search for you with my bare wrist. I defend you against the seaweed, the salt, the wakened fish. We faint under a wave. People tell of two that are drowned, of a fog mowing the beach. Midnight descends, covers my lips, keeps me from calling for help. We float, forgotten by day.
It is very nice to bring someone back from the dead. I don't mean that she's expired. I just mean that I'd never heard of her, and that you make this known through even books that are not recent. And that's very nice to resurrect someone who would not have life otherwise. Do you know, I marked Nietzsche because I had never read a poem by Nietzsche.
Oh, Nietzsche wrote some wonderful poems. I don't think you can understand the 20th century without coming to some kind of terms with Nietzsche, if we can ever understand the 20th century. One poem, small poem of his called Against the Laws. And everyone knows who Friedrich Nietzsche was. I mean, the best-known book is Zarathustra, but my favorite book is The Genealogy of Morals, I think. And Against the Laws. Starting now, the hours of the clock will hang on a hair around my neck. Starting now, the stars will stop in their courses, sun, cock, crow, shadows, and everything that time proclaimed is now deaf and dumb and blind. For me, all nature is silenced with the ticking of the law and its measure.
A much gentler
tone. I don't
know what
that poem means.
Well, it's a much gentler tone than he's known for.
Well, he was a gentleman. You know, his last act before he became insane, his last act of sanity was to, when he saw a man beating a horse in the street, Nietzsche ran out of the door and flung his arms around the horse, between the man and the horse, to protect the horse, and then he fell down in the street.
And they said George Herbert did the same thing.
George Herbert?
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful.
I have Asian figures, and the reason I have that is because East Window is either out or coming out from Copper Canyon.
Yes, it's out.
And that is Asian translations. This is a very...
It includes this book, Asian Figures.
That is why I have, I would like the audience to hear a taste of this. And you have but one poem by a Laotian figure, and it is lovely. It is beautiful. So I would like you to read that. Did you choose these Asian figures?
I should say what the whole point of Asian Figures was. I was working with ideograms, and with the ideogram way of writing, which is the way Chinese and Japanese are written. And I can't read ideograms, but I could read the kind of transliterations of each ideogram, and to try to figure it out. And in doing that, I was trying to see, working with tiny things like proverbs and odd fragments that came from these different, like riddles and things like that. It was an experimental kind of minimalism, trying to see what it was, how small you could get this unit that would be recognizably poetry. Because, you know, sometimes you don't know what separates poetry from prose, but you begin to recognize it. I thought, how small could this unit be when you would still say, yes, that's tiny, but you can see that it's poetry. And you mentioned George Herbert. George Herbert did a collection, which many people don't know, of proverbs. And some of those proverbs are very remarkable. They're quite clearly poems. I think very often proverbs and aphorisms and tiny things like riddles, if you look at them hard, they're poems. This was not a Laotian poem. This is a series of little tiny things that are even smaller than haiku.
You took fragments?
No, this is a series of them. There are six of these little teenies, you know. So it looks like six little stanzas of a poem. But they're separate ones, and they happen to fall into this order. Think of them as little proverbs or little tiny moments that show something. Says yes when nobody asked. Outside the ways of the old, the ghosts. When luck comes, keep your head. The more you want to own, the more you die. Close to death, you see how tender the grass is. High up, where nobody likes him.
It reminded me of that Italian form where you take one line from your great ancestors who were poets and make a poem out of it. Because that surely can be read as one poem also. Rather, of course, disparate. But like pearls on a string.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad we mentioned that. It is. I'm very glad. A lesser man would have fainted if anyone had handed him 10 of their old books. And we still have energy enough to look at this one. This is The Drunk in the Furnace, and I say 70s. Look, it was only $1.25.
$1.25.
At that time.
It was in 1960.
60, mm-hmm. I keep saying, and look, it's yellow. It's yellow with age.
Well, it would be. Mm-hmm.
But I like The Drunk in the Furnace. I think
That's
this
the
is the title
poem. It's the only time I ever had a title poem.
It's the only time you had a title poem in your book?
It's the only time that there was a poem, the title came from one of the poems. The Drunk in the Furnace. For a good decade, the furnace stood in the naked gully, fireless and vacant as any hat. Then, when it was no more to them than a hulking black fossil to erode unnoticed with the rest of the junk hill by the poisonous creek and rapidly to be added to their ignorance, they were afterwards astonished to confirm one morning a twist of smoke like a pale resurrection staggering out of its chewed hole, and to remark then other tokens that someone cozily bolted behind the eye-holed iron door of the drafty burner had there established his bad castle. Where he gets his spirits, it's a mystery. But the stuff keeps him musical, hammer and anviling with poker and bottle to his jugged bellowings till the last groaning clang as he collapses onto the rioting springs of a litter of car seats ranged on the grates to sleep like an iron pig. In their tar paper church, on a text about stokeholes that are sated never, their reverend lingers. They nod and hate trespassers. When the furnace wakes, though, all afternoon their witless offspring flock like piped rats to its siren crescendo, and agape on the crumbling ridge, stand in a row and learn.
I chose that because your daddy was a preacher man.
Yes, he was.
He wasn't a drunk by any means.
His father was, though.
I thought how interesting it is to find the beginnings of your imaginings, and knowing the strict way you were brought up, humor me a moment. If you had chosen to come through your parents, why did you choose that mother and that father to become who you are? What qualities did they have that made you, that you took for your soul's journey, for your life's work?
My father loved language in his own way, and I grew up hearing the King James Version, although, I mean, I think many of his theological tenets were never very close to me. My mother was a very strong character and gentle and determined and a person of great, great probity and patience and Those are wonderful, wonderful qualities. And when they both died in the same year, and when my mother died very suddenly when I was away, so that she was, the funeral was all over by the time I knew about her death. I went straight to the house and moved in and spent a month there giving things of theirs to their friends and eventually the furniture to my sister in the house. I sat there finally in the empty house.
Was it Scranton?
No, this was in western Pennsylvania, up north of Pittsburgh, near Indiana. But I remember that last morning sitting in that empty house alone before I drove away. And I sat there for a long time in the empty bedroom with just the sunlight on the floor. And it suddenly occurred to me that these were the right parents to have had.
W.S. Merwin, you who trust the dead and communicate so well with the dead, in honor of Mr. Porchia, we will send a sunbeam to him at the end of our program. Let us close with just a random aphorism.
You had your finger right under this one. It says, "Since I prepare only for what ought to happen to me, I am never ready for what does happen. Never."
The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. You have been listening to the voice of W.S. Merwin. This program has been brought to you by Forest Woods Media Productions. The series is called Favorite Poets, and it is a Library of Congress Bicentennial Project funded by the Madison Council. Our engineer was Brad McCoy. Post-production by Pam and Jim Smith of Muddy Hole Studios. I am Grace Cavalieri for The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.